Kia ora, welcome to What's in Your Kete, the podcast where we celebrate real people and their real stories. I'm Jane, your host for the day, and I'm over the moon to present today's extra special guest. This Māori queen comes all the way from the stunning east coast of Aotearoa, proudly standing as the youngest of four siblings, a devoted daughter, beaming aunt, and steadfast friend of mine. Nestled in Nga, Melbourne, she'll be dishing out tales of how she keeps her cultural flame alive down under. Let's give a warm welcome to my friend Candace. Kia ora, Candace. How are you? I hear you were living and working in Adelaide before moving to Melbourne for Mahi. Can you share a bit more?
It is interesting, to put it the least. Interesting, very different the past 12 months for me. Actually, my whole life is probably different every 12 months. Yeah, so just over 12 months now, living in Melbourne after moving in from Adelaide. I always wanted to. I always found that Melbourne would be a destination for me. Just the same, like I always felt Auckland would be a destination for me from East Coast. And so I always wanted to relocate out of Adelaide. I spent 5 years in Adelaide, my whānau were there. And then Mahi came up in the university, and so was able to transfer over, took up a contract, went through that wild roller coaster of a ride, which was really cool. It's just now I'm at a point of trying to decide what's next.
Have you faced any cultural challenges since being based overseas?
Yeah, that one was, I think, challenged a bit more at the start of it, where I put pressure on myself to go, now how are you going to stay Māori and live in a different country? It's not my first time I've lived overseas. I lived in the States for a little bit, but it was just a bit of a different journey. This was like I'm settling up and I'm relocating and I'm, you know, heading overseas. And I think at the start there was a lot of pressure around trying to figure it out. But then I realized, like, when you're Māori, you just are. Like, there's no like performance level you've got to now have on about it. I think having most of my two sisters live in Adelaide now and all the kids there, so it was a bit more, I think there was a bit more pressure from my siblings as well as to how do we ensure our kids understand who we are. And for some reason that became my responsibility of and she's coming over now, so now we're going to do some, like, Sunday night we'll have our, you know, whānau karakia and dinner and that, and then they'll have their, we'll have some songs and that go through, just, you know, easy stuff. But then there was this, can you teach us some of this? Can you teach? When I say that, I mean one sister is asking me and making her kids stand there and learn it. the kids got involved, so that was something we tried to just to have something for us. Good that we knew was natural back home, and especially back on the coast. You didn't kind of have a performative moment, you just are. And how do you kind of carry that on when you're somewhere else, but the environment you're in isn't the natural, you know, kind of spectrum of it? So that was interesting, it was fun. But you could see some of the kids are like, why are we doing this?
Well, you're the first to move away from home.
My brother left first. My brother left the coast first and, you know, oh my gosh, I can't even remember what year that started. Oh, it would be probably 98, and then 99 we went over. The reason we ever left the coast was through ministry. We travelled for church. And so he ended up on a trip to America where they'd travel into the reservations, just doing kind of different ministry. And he met his wife, his now wife. And so he did a lot of back and forth. He eventually ended up living there. I left next. I left when I was 18 and moved to Auckland for performing arts school. But then my two sisters and all of their, you know, their husbands and their kids, they all left and moved to Australia. So that was, during 2007, that's where majority of the family left the coast. And then a few years later, mum and dad left, did a bit of travel. And then the last of the house, our whare and everything was sold up. We had the whānau homestead in 20, 19. It was different for me. I was always going to be somewhere else. They always knew this one's going to do, she's going to be something different, something out the gate. And that was, you know, not so much of a surprise, but for my sisters to leave with their kids and their husbands, who are both of whānau from the East Coast, that was pretty big. That was a huge move and quite a big chunk of the whānau. And because they have the mokos as well, that's where it became a bit more difficult for mum and dad to be separate from them. When we finally, you know, when it finally did seal up the whare and Mangahoni Valley, that was a... I could understand why mum and dad were doing it. You know, they just like, we're the last two here now. Everyone's overseas. All our mokos are overseas. Why are we still here? And they had the church then, the Te Rongopai church there. So they, it was, I think, more of a calling of now's our time to leave. So they packed up and moved to Australia. They just really, they followed the grandkids because now they're in the States. Yeah, that was like, how are you going to do that? Because we did it for a little bit back in 99, again, through church. But this, we could only do 3 months at a time because of, you know, visa requirements and stuff. So because my brother has settled in, he now has 5 kids there, and he was able to kind of get green cards and that for mum and dad, get as parents and stuff, get them sorted in. It was quite interesting to see them go, oh no, we wanna be here longer. We do wanna settle down here. And now they're both working there now. Like they finished up mahi. They were doing a bit of jobs here and there in Australia, but didn't really need to, and then have basically reset their career life in America in their 60s and have started again. That part was a bit like, is mum and dad gonna like do this? How are they gonna do this, and how are they gonna settle into that life? I will add, they got green cards when Trump was president. Like, that's how we were like, how is this going to happen? So, you know, our whānau really saw that as, man, this really got to be God. They've really settled in to life there in the States, taken up their mahi, got them, I don't know if they're, well, mum's got friends, dad doesn't do friends. Mum's got her friend circle, got the kids. So, yeah, that was interesting for us as whānau outside to go, how are you going to settle into the States? Because we knew my brother had, but this was different for my parents to do so. But they always wanted to return back to the USA. When they first left the East Coast and then went to Aussie, they always knew that they were going to be going back to the States. I don't know what it was about that, but they've done it and they're there now.
Did you learn any waiata or cultural traditions during your time on the reservations?
I just remember having my 11th birthday in America, so around about that time. We went into, we stayed in Oregon a lot, so we traveled between Oregon and California, in the kind of, in the not so famous areas. But we ended up in Chiloquin, is what we called, is the place. Now, the reservation on in that area, I didn't even know, not even in just Chiloquin and Hooper and Klamath, these are all the areas that we would have traveled to. I wouldn't even be able to tell you, you know, what the specific zone is of this. We're now on the res, is what they would refer to. I also didn't even know what a reservation was. Like, I was just like, oh, we're staying here, all right. You know, I didn't know there was a difference. I didn't know there was a location that was dedicated just for our Native American. I didn't know that that's the place that they were kind of like, oh, we've taken this, but you can have that kind of conversation. I didn't know what that meant. So I was just in it. And there was one, I remember we had, I think it was in Chiloquin, and we was there with some of the elders. I think it was after one of our services. So we traveled around in what we called like a corridor revival. It's basically, it's a big marquee and it travels around and you pitch it up and then you just have services like there every night. We have some singing and you have someone speak. And so we traveled around just doing that. So we'd be performing our, you know, waiata and stuff like that. And then during one of these times, we went, and I remember being in this house because I think the boys had gone out and sat in, you know, when they do the, like, the sweat in the tents, and they just sit out in the teepee and do their own ceremonial stuff. So I think the boys had all gone out and done stuff like that, and then there was a time when they brought us into a whare, and they had a drum there, and they were just sitting around playing and, you know, singing their waiata. And then they let us join in and be able to play. And so they're like, okay, Candace, sit down. Here's, you know, this is what you're doing. You just hit. And you hit it. And you hit it in time with us. Like, oh, okay. Then my brother comes up next to me. He's like, don't screw this up. Don't go out of beat. Don't miss any of this. All right, just follow them. I was like, okay, well, now I'm really scared because I wasn't scared before, but now I'm scared. And then we're just sitting there. And, you know, all about all these, all the whānau, they're just singing, doing their own waiata, and I'm just playing and just sitting in amongst this room, just like, what is this? And that was amazing. It was amazing, this 10-year-old sitting there, really had no idea as to, you know, the history, but I knew something here was the same as home. It's like, This feels cool. This is, everyone's doing this right, and then realize, no, not everyone has that opportunity to experience that. But yeah, I was really blessed to be in that environment. Some of the whānau there now we still keep in touch with. But yeah, that was probably my first experience. And then another one was up in Hooper Valley, they called it, and that's actually where I was baptized, in their river. They had a massive river there. And when I stayed there, there was across the river, and you'd be like, okay, this is the reservation. So you could see, I was like, oh, okay, this side of the river is that, this side of the river is this. And we stayed on that side. We had a few services there, and it didn't, for me, I was like, yeah, this looks like home. This looks like the East Coast. You know, you just got your cousins running down the road with their random bikes, and I think they're all just crashing at someone's random houses. Like, it was just so free. That's what it felt to me. I don't understand, obviously, everything that's going on there and had gone on for them, but as a 10-year-old or 11-year-old standing there, like, this seems fun. Like, you know, just so open into that, and being accepted into the community there. But yeah, that's actually the river I was baptized in. It was a snow mountain, and my dad took me down there after a service, and yeah, baptized in the river at Hooper Valley.
Okay, so can we fast forward a few years and to that time where social media really started to blow up? And around that time, I know you had some interesting moments online, and there's one story in particular that I think you could share. What happened there? How did it all unfold?
First one was MySpace. It was MySpace. I remember us sitting at high school trying to figure out how to do the different backgrounds and stuff. I actually found MySpace a bit too confusing. I don't know, like, obviously I'm not tech savvy. But then quickly Bebo came around, and Bebo was the rest of my high school timeline, was queen of Bebo, I would say. So yes, it's interesting to see the evolution of social media from then to now. There was a lot more that we put into what the page itself looked like. Like, that was our learning point of web design, is, you know, in what you call it, like the background movements or the music that you had or where your friends sat in terms of top eight. But yeah.
Right, I do remember that. Gosh, I used to go to my local library and update my Bebo screen. I don't know if that's what to call it. And gosh, did I sink a bit of time, or what I thought was a bit of time back then, which is nowhere near the amount of time I spend on social media like these days. But hey, why I was asking you about Bebo. Now, I know that you've got a little bit of a funny story that came out of Bebo. So from being on the East Coast and being a bit of a Bebo user to then ending up in Tāmaki. Can you tell me about what happened? What kicked off on Bebo for you?
That Bebo life. Yeah, there was actually quite a lot kicked off for me on Bebo. But while I was down, while I was living on the coast, I had just finished performing art school in Tāmaki. And I wasn't there for vocals. And I went back to the coast and I just had no plans. Like, I was like, well, now what? While I was there, it was like summer, during the summer break. And while I was there, there was an ad on TV delivered by, it was Ollie Coddington and Gabrielle Putting-Atai at the time, who were My Time presenters. Anyway, they were on and I loved My Time. I loved that as a show. And I remember just seeing them and the ad was, we're looking for a third presenter and the show won't be, like, it was for a new show for IMTV. And they're looking for a new presenter and they just wanted people to submit a video of themselves and why they would want to be on the show, want to take up this role. And I think at that point, Bebo was kind of at its peak for New Zealand anyway, for Aotearoa, in terms of what the way we were using it. I think it was a smart way that they reached out and just went, we need to hear, we're trying to look for someone and the way you can connect to us is using your social channels. So the ad was, yeah, make a video, submit it to our Bebo channel online, to our page, and then we'll let you know, sort of thing. It's like, fine, whatever, what do I got to lose? I think it was like a 3-minute video or something like that. And it's not like I was doing anything else at any time. And I just thought, I always wanted to, you know, be on and work for My Time. I'll just give it a shot. And I recruited my nephew at the time. And gave him, and we had a camera. I don't know. Yeah, my whānau had a camera, just a digital, you know, flip screen one to watch camera. Gave it to him. I said, all right, just film me here. And we drove around Tokomaru. So I remember being down at the wharf. I remember being in like the ruins there. I think I was down on the beach and I was just, you know, I'm Candace from Tokomaru. Love this. Would love to show what our people are, or what our people can do. I wrote my own script. Don't ask me every detail of it because I don't know. And there was nothing, because I had no idea of how to do this. I don't know how to do an audition tape. Like, that's essentially what it was, an audition. I don't know any of the structure. I went to performing arts schools, but not for drama and not for television or movies. So I was just like, eh? It was really, I don't know. And so there's me and my nephew driving around to Tokomaru, and he's just like, okay, go. So I do owe a lot to him for putting up with that. You know, just, yep, yeah, all right, here you go. And I took it, and then I went to one of my whānau sisters, and she had a Apple, what is it? What do they call them then? iMac, I think. You know, big beast of a computer. Sat there and did all the editing. I hadn't used Apple before. I don't know what I was doing on that either. I was just clicking, cutting, and hoping for the best. So I edited the whole thing there. I remember sitting there late at night finishing it, and it was like such a huge file, which I didn't think about.
And was this 2008? Sorry.
This was 2007
or 2007?
2007. End of 2007, submitted. So probably, like, if anything, maybe January, February of 2008. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I might have recorded or something in December, January, and then because I remember the next few months after that kicking in. So yeah, start of 2008. So finished up the old audition video, and then went, well, I guess that, I don't know, that works. That's what I can give. That's the best that I think I can give, and the only thing I understand of how to give. So submitted it, and just like, and I could tell my whānau was like, he's Candace again on one of her big dreams of whatever. She's just come from performing arts school, which, you know, most people would think, and then what are you going to do after that? I know. I don't know either. So here I am making some random audition video on Bebo and submitting on Bebo and then seeing what happens. The next few weeks after that, the videos would go up and they were kind of individually just kind of filed through the Bebo page and people would have to vote on, you know, oh, I like this one. So then it opened up. I didn't realize that more people would see it. And so it was, you know, went nationally in terms of whoever was on following this channel were then able to watch our videos. So from the different people. That's where it got intimidating. Because
Now, so remind me, like, it has been a while since I've used Bebo. So did you have to upload the file into Bebo?
Yeah.
Is it like uploading a video file, like, into YouTube?
Yes, I think I can't actually remember if I just did it all privately and they put them up, right, or if I put it on my page and then like tagged it to them, like, you know, post on their channel. Aren't I can't remember if it was privately or not, but it was, yes, it went through YouTube, had to save to get the file and then submit through that way.
Wow. And so then it was like a public voting system.
Yeah.
I'm assuming off their wall.
Yes, of their wall,
would have been driving traffic to their page.
Yeah.
Right.
That's where it kicked in terms of intimidation for me. Because before that, it was just me and my nephew. Like, he's just recording. So I'm just talking to him, kind of walking around. Then when it goes up publicly like that, I don't know why I didn't register this in my head until it was on the that then I was like, oh, now I'm going to be compared. Now people were going to have their opinion. I wasn't too fussed about opinions. It was that I saw the other candidates who had submitted and they were good, you know, so that's where I went, oh, well, you know, we voted, but I'm none of these candidates. And a lot of them have been around television. And they were a common name. Like, you're like, oh, I've seen you before, or I'm aware of you. So they've been either in the industry, within media, some you knew who they were to an extent. So I was like, well, they know what they're up to. So for me, I was like, oh, well, that's it, kind of thing.
Like, had you told your whānau about this before it went live, or once the campaign went live, did you go, oh?
No, they knew.
Hey, do you want to vote for me in this comp? Like, did you go hard on telling people to vote for you, or was it just an organic thing?
It was, again, because I had no idea what the power of, I guess, a campaign.
Yeah, like,
you know, I was just like, right. I think I just assumed the producers would look at it, or whoever, and I didn't even know what a producer was. So I was like, the TV people would look at it and make their decision. And, you know, then it's like, we're putting it to the public. Oh, so there was a bit more of a conversation for me because it was all driven. There was no show running at the time. Like, IM wasn't a show. So there was no way of them to give instruction. It was purely everything via Bebo, that the instruction of what to do, how to vote, what's going on, the occurring, following, like, they paid for, obviously, TV ads and ran the basic of it. But then you had to drive it there. And so that's where it kicked in of, okay, now I've got to tell people, oh, I'm one of the candidates. Like, can you go have a look and drop your vote? So, yeah, it did. That's when I went, all right. So I did my kind of posts or my informing of whānau. And then the whānau just blew it. They went out and did their thing. So, that's a point, I think, in my career where you go, oh, that's why people have campaign managers. That's what people have, because that messaging and that traffic and that, I guess the touch points of how they do it is where it all kicks in. I don't know. I didn't even know how to do an audition. So I was just like, hope this worked.
Like, 2008, I'll be honest, I vaguely remember this campaign. I vaguely remember this campaign. And I was on Bebo, and I do remember thinking, hey, that's a real clever idea. Because at the time, I mean, gosh, it was Bebo, and social media was very, very different to how it is right now and how we use it. I mean, fast forward, 16, 17 years later now, and, wow, you know, there's been so many things that have happened in New Zealand anyway for social media campaigning.
Yeah, because then you sat down. You sat down at a computer. You had to go on dial-up. You had to clear your time frame to be like, I'm going to do my social media.
Yeah, totally. It was a time. Like, if I wasn't at the library, I was at the I was at the internet cafes. I totally remember, like, turning up when I had time in between life and what I was doing at the time, and trying to connect with my friends that are overseas. And that's how I was using Bebo. But to know that you're using it to audition for a new TV show that hadn't come out, That's really cool and super innovative. Like, shout out
to TVNZ. Yeah, I agree.
For that, I'm like, how innovative for its time. So, yeah, big ups to TVNZ for that one. And to know that it was a Māori production also for a new Māori youth show. So, how awesome. So, fast forward to the campaign runs, and then how did they announce the winners? Like, were you watching it every day? Like, what? How did they announce the winner or come to a decision?
Yeah, so they, a few weeks of it running, I got a phone call from the producer, and I was like, oh, you know, on my little Motorola flip top, whatever. And I remember talking to her, and she goes, oh, look, you know, we just want to congratulate you with you've been selected as one of the top. I think there were six of us who were top. And she goes, so what we want to do is we want to bring you up to Tāmaki and have a audition with the presenters, where they'll film you, do some kind of challenges and stuff. And then those will run on air. And that's where people kind of have their final say of picking them through
Whoa,
that.
Oh, so there was a second layer to this.
So then I had to go to Auckland. So, oh, okay, thank you. And then it was like, when do you need me there? And they gave the date, hung up, and said to mum and dad, I've got to go to Auckland now. Like, they want to do this. So I got on a bus into Sydney from Gisborne to Auckland. That's 10 hours. Ooh. That's 10 hours, right? Busted up. I stayed with one of my friends from the performing arts school. I said to him, hey, I've got this audition. He goes, you're staying with me. Come on, then we'll do this. And so I stayed there. I said, I don't know what I'm – he goes, oh, it's fine. And he drove me in, and I think we met at, like, Mission Bay or something. And so I pulled up. And it was Gabriel who did my audition with me, the presenter. So she'd go, all right, you know, talk to me about it. And then said, we need you to do this challenge. And I only remember one of them. And one of the challenges was to act out a scene from Paikia. And then I remember standing there at Mission Bay doing a scene of that and coming back in. I had intentionally worn my Hoko Whetuatu t-shirt to have the diamonds there, just to go, like, this is where I'm from, you know, this is home. I didn't look anything as a presenter would look. I was not dressed in a way that would be that. I just went up with what I knew how to give. So we did the audition part, and then they told me, so we are going to run these on air when the show begins. And I think the show kicked off in, like, late February. Something like that, or early March. They had pre-recorded all of these, everyone's audition, and then we went, and then they would do like three at a time. So they had the first episode had three, and then I think I was the second show on the following Saturday, and they told me yours is going to go on air here. So, you know, had a whānau watching everyone watch this. So we would, you know, just now IMTV had started without their third presenter. The show was about finding the presenter. And then it ran, and they called me up and said, yeah, it's yours. So how soon can you get up to Auckland? I want to give you a contract for all of this. And I was just like,
wow.
And I didn't have a fuddy. At the time. I was looking for a flat. I was looking for somewhere to stay. And I had agreed on somewhere to stay. That's right. And I hadn't got the job. Like, I didn't even know about the job yet. I was just like, well, I've got to find somewhere to stay. So I was like, confirmed, let's do this rental. And I found a housemate, and she got it. And my sister goes, but you haven't even got the job yet. I was like, oh, well, like, it is what it is. We got to go now. And so a week later, then they called and I got the job. So I did. So I did kind of like go out of sync, but paid off.
Wow. And so then from that, so you moved into your whare.
Yeah.
And then how long after that did you start?
It wasn't long. That was a quick turnaround. Like, I pretty much packed it up, boosted up to Auckland, settled in the whare. And I didn't even have a bed. I remember it was like an air bed. Like, I remember just trying to, my whānau came up with me. No matter whenever I transitioned, my whānau will kind of be there. So mum and dad, and they're just like, I was just on the floor. And the next day, so I went into the office to the TVNZ. They didn't even have a desk ready for me then. So I was just like sitting in this corner. And the aunties, we call them the aunties. The aunties come over and they had all this document. They're like, all right, you've got to do this. And here's your contract and this. And I remember looking at the salary, because we do year contracts for media, or for this one. I remember looking at the salary and I rung my mum. I said, what's like normal? Like, I don't even know. This is my first full-time job.
How old were you? Sorry, how old were you at this time? This is important.
I was 19.
Wow. 19, yeah. 2008. Yeah. You've just got this flat. You said yes to moving in with someone. You're on an airbed. You go into TVNZ. You don't have a desk. You get given some papers and a contract that you've never signed before, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
And calling your mum and saying, hey, mum, what's a good number? Yeah. Is this a good number?
Yeah. And she goes, yes, Candace. And I went, okay.
And I just... And then did you sign your name then?
Yeah, I was like, yeah, this is, and I printed my name. Like, that's, I didn't even have a signature. Yeah, so we went through on that, and then they came out, and so, like, the some of the crew were around. I think I was more, like, still starstruck. I was like, this is Ollie and Gabe. Like, this is, these are the My Time people. So, obviously, they revamped My Time and created this new show. So, I'm meeting the staff, and they're like, this, these are our researchers. These are our directors, and these are, and I, so I didn't know the components of what makes a television show, because obviously I only see who's on it. And then obviously there's got to be someone behind a camera, but everything else. So I'm standing in TVNZ, the new studios downstairs or whatever they do. I'm in this corner, and next to us, you know, to Waka Huia show, Te Karere, and all the crew there. And I'm, you know, I'm just, this is what I grew up on. So I was still just trying to navigate that, as well as move into a new whare and take on this job. So I'm sitting there. This part I do distinctively remember is the contract stuff. Whether it was that day or earlier, whatever. But they had a big conversation with me and said, so we need you to fly out tomorrow. You're going down south. Have you ever been to the South Island? I was like, nope. We need you to go to South Island. You and Gabrielle are going to go down there and film an episode. And your director will be with you and, you know, the camera crew. So we need you to get on a plane. A corporate cab will pick you up from your flight. What's your address? Oh, is my new address. Here you go. The corporate cab will come up. They'll pick you up. You just give them this taxi chit and that pays for it. I'm like, okay. Never seen a taxi chit and never seen a corporate cab. So then they're like, so these are all you need? Because we've got nowhere set up for you right now, you can go home, get things ready, and you'll be on the plane tomorrow. So it's like, and they're like, and this is what an itinerary pack is. And so they had this like Ziploc bag, and it was call times, where, you know, when you need to be, who the talent is, who you're meeting. I'd never seen any of that. So I was just like reading all these documents. Went home, and I was just exhausted, but I was on adrenaline because it's just... still trying to set up the whare, still doing this. Anyway, I'd packed everything that I needed. And then, does that happen then? No, not yet. And then in the morning, I woke up and I overslept because it was still just like, it was pitch black. I think I had to get the cab or something at like 5:30 or something. So still on my airbed, whatever. And my whānau had gone. I woke up, my housemate was there, and I was just like, they go, your cab's downstairs. Like, they're ringing me, like, we're here. And I was like, hang on. And my mates are like, she's coming. Just don't worry, she's coming. She's screaming out the window. And I was like, all right. So I just threw everything together, quickly got, and just bolted down. I remember we, you know, got in, got to the flight on time, landed in Greymouth, of random places, but landed in Greymouth, and we just shot our show. They just say, this is what you're gonna do. This is your, you know, they go, oh, so you know what a per diem is? No, what's a per diem? Like, okay, well, then you get this, and then you can pay that, and that gives back. Well, here's some cash up front. And they do it. This is your, you know, your room, you'll stay here, and the cab, like, we pick up the crew, and just the whole process. I just learnt as I went. I had no.
So this is like culture shock. I'm like culture shocked for you. Mm. So here you are from the coast. You know, yeah. Spend a tiny bit of time in Auckland, you know, for your,
mm-hmm.
for your training, go home, enter this online competition, do this audition, send it in, goes on Bebo, have to watch the voting, And next minute, you're like up in TVNZ signing papers, asking your mum if these dollar signs, these dollar numbers are, you know, for reals. And then you're late for your first cab. Thank goodness you made the flight. Wow, what a culture shock. How were you feeling when you were in Greytown? Were you like, what?
I think I was just going with it. You know, I was still on adrenaline. I was just going with it, like, now what? And then they're like, and now you say this. Okay. And now you do this. Okay, so I didn't really. I know if I look at my first couple episodes, for sure they'll be quite, I feel, unnatural for me in the way I present, because I didn't even know how I present. I didn't know who I was as a presenter. I was just in it, and like, it was fun. It was an enjoyable time, and the crew were really good. It was a good production crew to be introduced to the industry through, like, just, you know, Māori and Māori principles. And so there was really this quite whānau orientated aspect about it. So they were just kind of, and this is what it means, and now you're going to do this. Like, okay. Like, because I was just floating. And like, now you're going to talk to so-and-so. And it was just, I spent a bit of time watching the other two presenters as well. Just kind of like, oh, okay, so that's how they interact. Oh, that's what they say. Oh, they can ask a question then. And I just soaked as much as I could each day, just kind of trumping through it, because I knew I didn't have time to just stop. I couldn't just stop and go, wait a minute, I'm not sure. It's like, cameras on, go, just go. So I do feel that my personality and the, I guess, gifting of, you've just got to jump, so was what kicked into play there. Was, all right, lights on, go.
Like, yeah, were you ever... I think sometimes it's really good to not know. You don't know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. And, for someone that, you know, if you had to redo that whole process again right now in time, would you do it again?
Probably yes. Yes.
Like, knowing what you know, and also to, like, understanding life more.
Yeah.
And
I think it would, my delivery would be different in terms, well, obviously, but I'd be more conscious now. When I speak, oh, I can't really say that. Maybe I shouldn't say that. How would I be perceived? What does that mean? What does that reflect? Like, that's what I'd be thinking now. Where then I was like, hello.
this is Candace.
Museum. You know, like, I don't know.
This is the museum.
Yeah. We are at an old Western town. And then we're, like, acting all these stuff. So there was a lot more. So I was there in a total of 3 years, but throughout the process, I did kind of find my feet and went, I know I don't do this part well, which was like acting, where you were like scripted as a different character. I wasn't really, I just went, I don't like that. For me personally, I don't like that style where we were an FBI agent or something, where you had to put on a persona to be them. What I enjoyed most was I had talent, so someone to interview. And I just was able to do a bit of research on them and then find banter. That was that for me. And quick-witted banter, which was something you just had to learn. And you learned if you have siblings or ever brought up on the East Coast, you know how to roast, because you just have to for survival. But that really came into play for me, in that having that ability, I would continue. But there would be things that I'd be like, I'm not doing that. Like now, if I did it again, I'm not doing that. That's not.
Okay, so Candace, what advice would you give to those that are a little bit more risk adverse, or wanting to, you know, try something new, or looking for some new energy? What would you, or breaking into a new industry or something of the kind? Yeah, what sort of advice would you give them?
I think something I learned for me when I went into television was, I wasn't really sure who I was, you know? And of course at that age, I didn't really realize I had to know that. Like, it just wasn't a thing. But because of the type of industry I was in and the role I played in it, there was a lot of opinion shared towards what I do, the way I look, the way I speak, the way I act, was given opinions were coming in left, right, and center. To me, who then had to kind of go, oh, okay, that's right. Oh, no, that's not right. Oh, that's right. Oh, that's not right. So it gets a bit difficult. It was really difficult for me to know what to listen to, what not listen to. And people were coming with the best intentions, but then you had Bebo. And the feedback was coming in via Bevo from the general public as well. I'm not saying there was, I didn't actually cop a lot of negative. Maybe the most negative was, you know, why can't she speak Reo Māori? Why is she not speaking Reo Māori, but the others are? It was probably the biggest one I copped. But there was a lot of me as a person from the industry. And so my advice and what I didn't know then was understanding who you are in whatever, because that foundation of such is going to be shaken when you step into an unknown territory, whether it be television. Mine was just, for me, it just felt extreme for me, because it wasn't just the industry that was critiquing, it was the general public that was critiquing, and then my whānau. So not that I disagreed with everything, it's just a lot to take on at that point, where I was still trying to buy a bed. Like, you know, I didn't even know what a salary was. And then here I was, like, signing contracts. So there was a lot to consume in that time. So my advice to someone is, if you're going to step into some other industry or crack into something or do something that's, you know, really different for what you're doing now, try and have a figure out of who you are as a person. Like, what makes you tick? What is something you need for calming? Like, for me now, I know I'm an introvert who can be extrovert. So I can perform, I can go on, I can do all that, but I need my downtime immediately after. I need silence. I need my isolation. If I don't, it comes out on other people. And so I just know for me that when I tick over, I'm like, oh, okay, I can do that, but I know I need a retrieve. And because I know those are the types of tools I require to operate at the best, now I can go into these things a bit more prepared. And that's, I didn't know that about me. I just burnt because I didn't know. I wonder why at home. I was just like, I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to talk to anyone. It was just thought I was in a foul mood. No, it's just because I used all my social energy as soon as I walk out the door, because I have to, because now I'm a public face. But when I was back home, it was just shut down and let me shut down. And I didn't know that that was something, that was me, that's how I operate. So I think, you know, something as simple as what makes you energized and what do you need to re-energize when entering something new is a real strong foundation to have, because otherwise everything's going to be new, everything. So something has to be solid for you. But yeah, I think just that core of understanding. It seems a bit too broad as a comment. You should know who you are. Like, yeah, okay, thanks. But those, like, something like that, it wasn't until years later that I realized, oh, because what my housemate at the time was like, how come you don't, like, when you come home, you don't even talk. It's like, and I'm grateful for you, because she helped me kind of adjust to a lot of things in Tamaki, but I didn't know what I needed was, because every element of me is working outside that door. When I step it, this is a safe place, so I need it to be safe. And safe for me is silence. Silence, no more smiles, no more, like, just let me zone, because I've got to go back out and have that level to give to people again. And I can, as long as I get what I need. So, yeah, something really simple of what's going to help you go through this new territory of whatever it is that you're trying to break into is going to be your best thing, because at least there's something solid you can come back to that, you know, well, at least I have my cup of tea time at this. That's, I know I need that. If I don't have that, I'm not going to, like, everything else that I'm about to do is new. Every piece of information, every meeting, every person I meet is going to be brand new. So what's going to be my solid? And that would be now my advice. Even if I went back to myself, I'd say, you know, when you come home, yeah, that's what's happening. Lock the door, go to sleep.
Well, thank you. I like that you aimed that you even acknowledged that to yourself now to them, because that was going to be my next question, was what do you have to tell yourself, you know, back then? And I think it's a beautiful reflection on your life journey and within yourself. as a Māori woman, and also as a daughter, as a sister, as a friend, especially now. And I think in these times, just life seems a lot faster now. And I know it's not a subject that a lot of people want to bring up, but we've all just come out of, the pandemic. So that's a whole quarter that we'll have to do again another day. But, you know, coming outside of the pandemic and coming outside of a time when the world shut down as a result of that, social media has blown up in the biggest way, and I'm not going to say as a result of the pandemic. But I'm like seeing the likes of TikTok pop off since pandemic. And I guess so that was why I did want to add in your experience with Bebo and your story too, because
even during that time, like when I say we sat down for, now was my Bebo time. It was like sitting down for Shortland Street or something, I don't know, but you had your time blocked out, because maybe not blocked out, but it was like, now I'm in the computer, I have put a dial up on, like, now it's done. We're here because everything's on your phone. It just is every part of your. If you're standing there and there's a moment of silence, the phone's out. If you're getting on the train, the phone's out. So it's part of every day. It's like you're on social media unless looking at something else. Like that, it's more time given to it now than it was back then. We were using it and we were utilizing it in a different way. But now it's more prominent that I'm going, and we're given so much, we feed so much via it.
Oh, absolutely. Like back then, when I think about Bebo was a connector for me, for a lot of my friends that were living overseas or that were living around the country, or when I was living out of Auckland, when I moved overseas or when I moved to the South Island. I just wanted to stay connected, and I did and Bebo was a dedicated part of a day or once a week, I jump on, whatever it was, that was that. And opposed to, look now, and I've just retrained myself in recent months to actually come off social media and not live in it, not live in the zone like I really have. And look, it has been, and I just think it's really interesting, and the reflections we have as people, and just, how do we operate?
Because even during that time while I was in television, and I don't think at the time in 2008, and probably 2009, we were very aware of the impact, like negative impact socials could have, because we hadn't fully experienced it. And look, I'm no All Black, so I wasn't cropping like that kind of following. It was just, you're public. So there would, like, during my time of having my own personal Bebo page is what I was using. And then it started to be like, there's other people talking to me and I don't know who they are. And now there's photos of the kids on here of my nieces and nephews, and there's interactions. So it's like, I don't really want that world crossing into my world here. I didn't realize this was something I had to consider. So I ended up creating a new Bebo page separate and making that one private. And, now I have my presenter profile, which allowed us to interact with the guests and with people who are watching the show, with viewers, and communicate to them the way we wanted to, which was, that was the point of having Bebo's, come on Bebo and tell us, ask us questions, look at this, what do you think of this, and have that. But I needed them to be able to communicate to me, but not see my niece and nephew. Like, they didn't have to make that. But it was just something that I went, we've got to do that. We've got to think like that. I don't know where to think like that. And so I then had to separate probably like a year in and create a different profile for this, which was, I never had thought that would be something. It's like, now it's like, Like, there's like how many pages, like, follow this for my fitness journey and this one for this and this. It's just normal. But then I didn't realize the extent that socials could travel. And that's where, the point of social media, as we were sold, was to have direct communication with people and hear their voice at their point in time and get the news right there and what's going on then and there, without all the filters of going on to to the news channel. Where now everyone's aware that that's all we can use it for. So now you're still like, but is that the truth, or is that was that now propaganda? So there's a lot more filtered because people are just more savvy. They're more savvy with it. But the intention of it was to have a direct connection with people who you just couldn't get to. You know, like, so you could talk to the presenters of a show, ask your content then ends up on TV, and we end up coming to visit you in your town, sort of thing. So that was the point we were using it for. Just obviously the world of internet has far more ability than I considered. Me. Yeah.
A very, very interesting time. We know what you'd say to your younger self now. I guess, do you have any other parting words for anyone else that's listening to this podcast today? Mm-hmm. Like, if there's one thing you hope someone takes away from your story, or from part, and this is a very small part of your life story, mm-hmm. I do want to express that. Yeah, and for someone who doesn't know you and that does listen to this, what do you hope they take away from our corridor? And I guess, what do you want to put into their kete? You know, what is there something, you know, from your kete to someone else's kete, what do you hope that they take?
I think, the main tool of figuring out what it is you need for yourself to get through that, you know, that new, adventure, really, that solid, what is that one piece of truth, or what is that one thing that ticks for you that makes things work for you, then you can be the best at what you're trying to give. That's my main parting of how to step into a zone. I think one of the things stepping away from that, I guess, chapter of my life, I loved it. You know, I got so much out of that. Then most of the conversations too, when I go back to Aotearoa, is are you from, and honestly, there's people who still ask that. I'm like, how old were you? Like, how old were you when this was out? I was in it, that I didn't really understand the impact it had across other people, and positive, you know, positive or negative, whatever. I didn't understand the extent it could travel, because I was just there. Like I said, with the Bebo audition, here's a camera, film it, edit, submit. Like I was just in that moment. I didn't really consider what else was going on around. Impact it. The people who are on the journey with you, whether physically there with you there, or, you know, your whānau back home, or your community, for Tokomaru, for your community, the East Coast, who are there with you through that, I didn't understand how much I needed them. You know, I needed them. And I, even my flatmate, my first flatmate when I moved into Auckland, I don't know, but she was like, okay, so when we pay bills, like, how do you pay a power bill? I don't know. Like, how do I pay a bill? Like, just those sorts of things that came along in this journey that I didn't know I needed, but they were just there. They were just there. And having that, now when I look back and I just wanted to acknowledge them, I would not have survived a real drastic change in lifestyle, in career, in location, without that at all. Like, they have provided that. And so if people are feeling like, and it's not just like, you know, got to be your bloodline whānau, these were just different people, my community. And I didn't know that until I went home and they said, no, you will always be Tokomaru. And that was because I wasn't born on the East Coast. I was bred on the East Coast, which does make a difference, people. When you are bred somewhere in the East Coast, breeds. Like, and so to then be acknowledged, no, you are Tokomaru. And I remember hearing that from one of the aunties there during this time and going, man, that's home. You know, this is, I have a home. I have people behind me. I have not behind me, but ones I could carry and go, when I'm going to present, I'm going to represent you. So I think my other piece of advice is to look out for those who are just along the journey, bloodline or not. There's ones who are just like, man, you were there at a time and place that I didn't realize I needed, but I needed. And there's still ones I probably haven't even acknowledged yet because I just didn't realize. I still don't know. But I didn't know I needed them the way I had them. I think, yeah, that advice is look out, just look out for that. Be aware of that because they're valuable.
Awesome. Kia ora. Well, thank you so much for your time with us today. Candace, are you on social media and do you want people to follow you? is there, you know, like other people sign up their blog and they're like, and you can follow Candace at do. Do you want people to follow you?
You guys can, but it's probably like boring. But my Insta will probably be the best one. That's actually more.
All right, then you can follow Candace on Instagram, which we will add her Instagram in at the bottom of this podcast somewhere or on my socials when this eventually goes to post. But yeah, ngā mihi nui ki a koe. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us. And this will not be the last of Candace. You will hear more from her in time to come, whānau.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. That's a wrap on today's episode of What's in Your Kete. How good was that? If you loved hanging out with us, don't forget to hit the subscribe button, share the love with your mates, and drop a review. We'd love to hear from you. Catch you next time for more epic stories and life-changing takeaways. Stay awesome and see you on the next one.